We'll pick up the countdown shortly here. In H-minus 10 seconds, the countdown will come directly from the timing and firing trailer.
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0.
Quantel, opt in, opt in. Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
One other party is in this conference.
I mean, I expect that in a fantasy story, but at some point I have to, you know, at some point it has to be made clear. Yeah. Okay. Sorry about that. I'm a little late again. My mistake. I was reading something, a manuscript of a friend of mine, and missed the time. He's going out sailing, and I wanted to go sailing with him, but I'm feeling a little iffy, and I don't want to find out what that iffy means when I'm on a boat, you know, 500 meters offshore. Little bitty catamaran, two-man catamaran, wouldn't hold three, not of my size and his. Anyway, so for those of you listening in, I apologize for having been late to pick up. I'm doing this very much by guess and by God here. Anyhow, so what do I have to say? Well, there's a few things. One of them, my friend is very dubious about the idea of, I'm sitting with him here in Grand Beach Provincial Park, near the south end, but not at the south end of Lake Winnipeg, which is considered the sixth largest lake in Canada by surface area, the other five being the Great Lakes, I suppose. I believe so. Anyway, but it's much shallower than the Great Lakes. He says the deepest part is 120 feet or, you know, more or less 40 meters, and most parts of it aren't more than 3-4 meters deep. Anyhow, but he expresses doubt about battery electric cars on the simple ground that where he's from, even IC engines need block heaters. And so you have to keep the car plugged in, even in the garage. And if it's not in the garage, you know, on street parking in the winter in some place like Winnipeg or Calgary is an extremely questionable business. Of course, this runs into how I've suggested that parking meters, coin-operated parking meters, are a good idea and that they ought to have an electrical hookup. And here comes in a thought I had the other day, which is that one good thing about LED street lamps is that they free up a certain amount of current, which might be used for these chargers on parking meters. Now, my comment on that is that chargers on parking meters will be limited in terms of current. Now, you might be able to pay more to get more current, but I think in a lot of places, you know, you might get 1 amp or 2 amps, and that's not going to charge your car in less than several hours, but what it will do is keep you afloat. And a lot of the time, that float is what you need. In any case, however, you know, as I say, he's dubious about the battery electric car for various reasons. Firstly, he's driving a car that's nearly 20 years old now, and the best estimates for current technology car battery packs don't give them more than 8 or 10 years of service life. And so he'd be on his second battery pack looking at his third at this point. And that's a concern. But the other thing is that the batteries mostly don't work very well in cold temperatures. Now, down in Texas, where I live, I see a lot of Teslas. And frankly, I'm sure there are other electric cars that I'm not seeing because the Teslas are distinctive enough. The others, I don't know what to look for, although I did see a Rivian electric pickup truck the other day with Illinois plates. So I don't know if it was just in town for a while or if it was hanging around. But be that as it may, there are prospects for improved battery technologies, ones with longer service lives, ones with better low temperature tolerance, ones which might be less costly to manufacture. But I don't, you know, the thing that has had lithium ion batteries be so prominent so far is simply that because of the great demand for them, for laptop computers and so on, the manufacturing base has been there, and it's easier to start up. It's easier to scale up an existing manufacturing process than start from zilch. So that, again, is a very interesting problem. But ultimately, however, I think, what we're faced with is the Bazalgette problem. In other words, did you overbuild your infrastructure when you had the chance? Because what we're looking at now is a very strong press. People are saying, well, we need to get people away from fuel-burning vehicles and into battery electric cars. And they're saying, we need to get people away from gas heat or, God forbid, oil or coal heat in their houses and to electric heat pumps. Well, and here's the question. In the past, I've said, I'll believe electric vehicle mandates when I start seeing streetcar tracks being laid down and overhead wire going up, because people who don't have a garage to put a car in are going to have a much harder time keeping an electric car charged, right, than with a gasoline car, which you fuel in 5 minutes. Now, there's an argument to be made that a battery car is a parallel rather than a serial operation. In other words, if you're driving a long road trip, you stop at a restaurant, you put it on to charge while you eat in the restaurant, you come back 40 minutes or an hour later, and you've got your charge as well topped up. But, of course, this does assume that you've got 40 minutes to an hour to stop at a sit-down restaurant on your way from A to B, which is not guaranteed. And again, this is my argument that the Postal Service, for example, and other delivery companies and bus companies are ideal markets for battery electric vehicles because their daily route length can be known in advance. You know when you send them out, how far they're going to go. And so you can just make sure they get back to the barn when they need to recharge. That's easy. In a car-oriented city where you have to do all kinds of errands, it's not that easy. And again, what do we know about total cost of ownership for battery electric cars? We know that it's heavily dependent on the price of electricity. Now, I want somebody to tell me how you're going to get people out of gasoline cars and into battery cars, and how you're going to get people out of gas heat and into heat pumps when the price of electricity is 30 or 40 or 50 cents a kilowatt hour, the way it is in Berkeley, the way it is across Germany, the way it is in Denmark. That doesn't seem to me like it's going to be an easy thing to accomplish. Yes, you can tell people that there's a threat of climate change, but ultimately, people have a tendency to do what's expedient for them right then, and just basically on the fact that, you know, yes, you know, what's coming may kill you, but if you starve to death this winter, it doesn't matter if bad eating, you know, heart disease kills you in 20 years. You'd much rather eat whatever it is you have to eat and not starve and let the heart disease 20 years down the road worry about itself. And so it's very difficult to convince people to take measures which will leave them poor, which, to a great extent, I'm afraid, is a part of green advocacy. They're always on the hair shirt bandwagon, if I can mix a metaphor that way. So we have the Bazalgette problem, namely, did you order substation transformers, which are big enough to deal with the fact that you're tripling the number of kilowatt hours that are being pulled? Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're tripling the number of amperes that are being pulled at any given time. Fortunately, if people are charging their cars at night mostly, then since demand is usually slack at night, it helps to even out the load factor, which is all to the good, at least for conventional power equipment. If people are using more electricity in the winter, well, in places like Manitoba, where the peak load is already in the winter, you definitely need to beef up the transformers. If people are using more electricity in the winter in Texas, then the distribution infrastructure and even the transmission line infrastructure is probably mostly adequate. Note my qualifiers there, probably mostly. I would still want to go up to at least the next larger size of transformer, just maybe not double or triple the size of transformer. But again, this leaves us with questions such as, where is that power going to come from? Because right now they're saying, oh, well, everything's hunky-dory in Texas. Yes, we're having some very, very hot summer days. But you know what? The solar, all that solar that we installed is working great because the air conditioning loads are greatest when there's more sun. All right, I'll buy it. Okay, I'll buy that. Now, the question then is, if you want people to use heat pumps, what you really mean is you want the electric loads in the winter to rise practically to meet those in the summer, because an air conditioner and a heat pump are the same machine, just run in different directions. And generally speaking, the temperature difference between the inside of the house and the outside of the house, which is what determines how much power you need to run the compressor motor, that's generally less in the summer than it is in the winter. If you're trying to get up from 30 degrees or 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 70 degrees, which is the minimum most people feel comfortable at, you know, so you're looking at a 30 to 40 degree difference. Whereas if you're trying to get down from 95 Fahrenheit or even 100 Fahrenheit to 75, and frankly, I prefer to set my air conditioner 78 or 80 Fahrenheit, and I'm quoting in Fahrenheit, not because it's the units I'd rather use, but it's because it's the units that the thermostat I have to use is registering, then the temperature difference is smaller. And, you know, again, the power demanded by a heat pump is largely a function of the temperature differential between the endpoints, and it's, you know, you have to get out the chart of heating degree days, which is available from the American Society of Heating and Refrigeration and Air Conditioning Engineers, and you have to figure out, okay, in your particular city, is the demand for heat, as it's for terms of number of degrees of heat, number of days, is that greater or less than demand for cooling? Now, again, this only gives you a first-order approximation to the amount of power that you're going to need for your heat pumps. But still, it gives you an idea. Well, if the system works really well with solar generation in the middle of summer when there's, you know, direct sunlight beating down, you've got lots of direct solar gain, and that's the biggest thing driving your air conditioning demand, well, in the middle of winter when it's frequently overcast and the hours of sunlight are shorter and the intensity of the sunlight is less, then you can't count on that, which means that you've just spent a whole bunch of time and money promoting and investing in a system for delivering energy, which is not going to be there when you want it. That doesn't seem wise. But again, I'm going to believe that people are serious about battery-powered car mandates and about heat pump mandates when I start seeing new substation transformers being installed to handle the loads. And of course, there's other facets of this, right? So for example, in the area around Phoenix, Arizona, they've had serious problems. They're constantly short of water, and they're having serious power shortages. And some reason this is the fastest growing region in the country, I think the best thing to do is to encourage people somehow to move to Buffalo, New York. That'd be my solution for it. Don't encourage them to move to Phoenix, which is in the middle of a desert. Encourage them to move to someplace where there's plenty of water. And what we need to do in terms of things like tax law to encourage that is a very interesting question, and not one for which I have good answers. I will, however, say that another facet of this business of substation transformers and pole transformers and so on, I say they're having power shortages in Phoenix. Somebody says, build more solar. They had to put a stop to it. There were lots and lots of people putting rooftop solar on in Phoenix, and what was happening is that they were overloading the substation transformers. Because, of course, substation transformers are normally intended to go from the higher voltage distribution lines to the lower voltage lines that go out to your pole transformer and deliver it to your house. Well, when you start running that backward, you find that the capacity of the substation transformers becomes somewhat congested. And basically, they had to ban, or at least severely restrict, new rooftop solar installations in Phoenix because the distribution infrastructure couldn't handle it. So again, Are they installing lots of new substation transformers to deal with the more solar that you say they should install to meet the power crunch? You know, again, these are not necessarily easy questions, but the other thing about them is that they are not trivial questions. That if you're going to enact a policy, you have to look at what that policy implies. You have to say, what is level 2, level 3, level 4? What are the consequences? What are the things I have to provide in order for this policy to succeed? You know, Basil Gett, his objective was to drain the sewage away from London. But when he did that, he said, well, of course, if I'm going to drain it, I have to drain it to somewhere. And the result was they built the Victoria Embankment. And what they wound up doing was essentially building a very long pipeline to discharge this sewage at a point where the currents in the English Channel would carry it away. Because if they just discharge it into the Thames, things would not really get much better. But that's the thing. Basil Gett massively oversized his drains. And as a result, the capacity was available when the Otis elevator came in, when tall buildings started being built, et cetera, et cetera. And at one time, there were businessmen in electric companies, or there were managers in municipally or state-owned electric organizations who understood that it was a good idea to oversize the equipment. The cabin I'm staying in now has a 100-amp electrical service panel and a 100-amp electrical service coming to the cabin. Now, you might think that's a bit oversized for a vacation cabin, but the gentleman who put the panel in was the owner of the cabin, and at the time he had, you know, house construction for a long time had been 60-amp panels, and 100-amp panels were just beginning to come in, and he shrugged his shoulders and said, you know what, I might as well put in a 100-amp panel, because in another 40 years, and it's now 60 years since this cabin was erected. There's a thing on the wall that says 1963, and I'm reliably informed that that was put up when this cabin was put up. Nobody today would or could build a house in the U.S. or Canada with a 100-amp electrical service panel. You wouldn't just be laughed at. It's against code. You know, you'd need a, 200 or 250-amp service panel, even if you didn't have that size of a service from the electric company. And of course, if you want to charge your electric car, you'd really better have a 250-amp service panel and the 250-amp service to go with it. So yeah, that's the Basil Gett problem. Did you oversize your infrastructure when you put it in? Because that's the best chance you're going to get. Coming back in and ripping things up is always more difficult than putting them down in the first place. And the city of Winnipeg, as it turns out, is wrestling with that. I was reading in the local newspaper, and they do have a local newspaper here, and it's relatively economical, 75 cents Canadian for a weekday paper, and it's as much as the Startlegram charges, gives you for three or four times that, I think. Anyhow, but they were saying that they've still got a lot of undivided sewer, in other words, mixed stormwater and sewer and, you know, sanitary sewer, and that they have a plan to separate 80% of that by the year 2095. And I'm thinking, that's not nearly ambitious enough. I'm sorry, you know, you've got to figure out when is the next time you have to repave and relay your streets. And every time that you're pulling up a street, you need to be replacing the drains under it. That way, you should be able to get it done in a much shorter period of time, at a maximum 40 years, because every street has to be pulled up and completely relayed every 40 years. That's pretty much the longest you can wait and get away with it. And my figures are for Texas. Winnipeg, where they have frost heaves, I suspect the interval is shorter. My informant asserts that the street design is done to tolerate frost. I congratulate the people who design them that way. And now I'm going to give you one other thing to talk about, which is the thought of transit poverty. And this is a thing I've been thinking about since I was in middle school, and a useful little book called The Statistical Abstract of the United States furnished me with average figures across the U.S. for owning and maintaining a car. In other words, total cost of ownership figures. And I was shocked because I realized that people who are driving a car are in many cases paying it more than minimum wage, in effect. Now, to me, driving a car is a job, it's work. So I'm always happy to give it to somebody who gets paid for doing it, a bus driver, a train driver, what have you. And so the thought that, for many people, owning a car costs them what they would make at a half-time job, because, of course, this was averaged across the entire country, and there are significant population centers, New York being the best-known one, of course, parts of Chicago, where you really can get away without owning a car. You really can get away without driving. And so the thing is, people are effectively working at least a half-time job at minimum wage just to support their car. I'd much rather support a kid than a car. But the flip side of that is, in places where you don't have to own a car, and big chunks of New York City are like this, we've allowed the landlords to run the rents up to the point that people aren't getting the benefit of not having to have a car. In other words, it's costing them extra to live where they don't have to pay the amount needed to keep a car. Now, you've all heard by this point my thoughts about punitive taxation, confiscatory taxation of landlords who hold units off the market. You've heard my ideas about starting with trailer parks and moving on to apartment complexes, converting as many as possible into co-ops owned by the people who live there, so there's not somebody taking money out of the trailer park or the complex. You know, they still have to pay for the maintenance, and frankly, most apartment complexes I know, you better be paying into a sinking fund as well, because the construction isn't that great. You're going to have to tear it down and rebuild it. But ultimately, we have to make sure that people aren't being priced out of the ability to not drive. Because ultimately, you're going to pay more in municipal taxes and that kind of thing.